Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Really glad you could join us today. We're setting out on a pretty interesting mission to basically crack the code of your paycheck. I mean, have you ever looked at your salary or just wondered why some jobs pay so much more or why sometimes companies just can't seem to hire people fast enough? Well, we've gathered a whole stack of sources, articles, research notes, all about the labor market, and we're gonna distill the really important stuff, the forces that shape your job prospects, your earning potential. Okay, let's unpack this. Today, yeah, we're diving deep into the core mechanics of the labor market. We're really pulling back the curtain on what actually influences how much you earn and, you know, what jobs are out there for you.
And what's, I think, fascinating here is how these concepts, which can seem pretty abstract, economic stuff, right? They directly impact your day-to-day life. We're talking job prospects, what you can earn, even how much it costs to live somewhere. We'll dig into demand and supply, concepts like marginal revenue product. Sounds technical, but it's crucial. And importantly, how different market setups, you know, from perfect competition to markets with strong unions or minimum wages, change the whole picture.
Okay, so let's start right at the beginning. The foundation, demand for labor. I mean, why does a company hire someone? It's not just for the company picnic, right? It's because there's demand for what those workers produce. Like the sources say, if people want more cars, car companies need more workers. It's derived.
Exactly. Derived demand. That's the key phrase. A firm doesn't just randomly decide to hire. It's driven by, well, several things. First, how productive is the labor? If one worker can make more widgets per hour, that worker's more in demand. Simple enough. Then the price of the actual product matters. If the price of those widgets goes up, the revenue each worker generates goes up too, making them, you know, more valuable to hire.
Also, what about substitutes? Like, if robots get way cheaper than people for doing the same task, well, that changes the calculation.
Oh, technology, yeah. That can cut jobs in one area, but maybe create new ones somewhere else, right? Like managing the robots.
Precisely. Technology is a huge one. And even just having the other resources needed. Like, you can't hire weavers if you don't have any thread.
Yeah.
So availability of raw materials, that matters too. Okay, that makes sense. So let's say wages drop. A company might just decide, great, let's hire a few more people at a lower cost. That's moving along the demand curve they already have. But what if, say, a new invention makes every worker way more productive? Then the company wants more workers at any wage. That's a whole shift of the curve itself, isn't it? Like changing the whole demand picture.
Exactly right. You've got movement along the curve because of wage changes and shifts of the curve because of those other factors, productivity, technology, product price, and so on. And this leads us nicely into the marginal revenue product theory, MRP. It sounds a bit academic, but honestly, it's fundamental to how firms think about hiring. So MRP is basically the extra revenue a company gets from hiring one more worker.
Okay, extra revenue. How did they figure that out?
Well, the formula is marginal physical product. That's the extra stuff the worker makes times the price of that stuff. MPP times price. And here's the kicker. A profit-maximizing firm, in theory, will hire workers right up to the point where the MRP equals the wage rate.
Ah, so if the extra revenue you bring in, MRP, is more than or equal to your wage, you get hired. If it's less, you probably don't.
That's the core idea, yes. And it explains why the demand curve for labor slopes downward because of diminishing returns. You know, the first extra worker adds a lot. The 10th maybe adds less. So their MRP falls.
Right, diminishing returns. So that MRP curve is effectively the firm's demand curve for labor, showing how many people they'd hire at different wages.
Wow. Okay, so that covers the firm side why they want to hire. Derived demand, MRP. It's all about the value a worker brings. But what about the workers themselves? What makes us want to supply our labor to a particular job or industry?
Good question. We need to look at the supply side now. And just like demand, it's influenced by a mix of factors. Some are about money, some aren't. The wage factor is pretty straightforward usually. Higher wages tend to attract more people to offer their labor.
Makes sense, right?
Yeah, more pay, more takers. Seems obvious.
Generally, yes. But how much more supply you get for a wage increase, what economists call elasticity, that really varies. Think about, say, needing more brain surgeons versus needing more checkout clerks. A wage bump might attract lots more clerks, but maybe only a few more surgeons because the training is so long and specific.
Right, the pool of potential workers is different. Makes sense. But what about the non-wage stuff? I feel like that's often huge for people deciding on a job.
Oh, absolutely huge. Sometimes even more important than the salary number itself. We're talking about working conditions. Is it safe? What are the hours like? Mm-hmm. Is there flexibility? Then, career progression. Are there chances to learn, get promoted? Job satisfaction. Do people actually like the work? Does it have status?
Benefits too, I guess, like health insurance, pensions.
Definitely. Fringe benefits are a major one. And also things like how easy it is to move for a job, geographical mobility or switch careers, occupational mobility. Job security is another big one. And even sort of the social standing of the profession.
So again, if the wage changes, people might offer more or fewer hours, or more people might enter the field that's moving along the supply curve. But if, say, working conditions dramatically improve in one industry, or maybe a new training scheme makes it easier to qualify, that could shift the entire supply curve outwards, right? More people willing to work at every wage level.
Precisely. Other things that shift the supply curve include big demographic changes, like the population getting older, or major migration flows. Changes in what other jobs are available can affect it too. Or government policies, think about taxes on income, or the level of unemployment benefits. These change the incentives to work. Mm-hmm. And even just people's preferences. Maybe more people decide they value leisure time more. That could shift supply inwards.
Okay, so we have firms demanding labor based on MRP, and people supplying labor based on wages and all those non-wage factors. So how does this all come together? How do we actually end up with the wage that lands in our bank account?
Right, the moment of truth. Well, in a theoretical perfect labor market, lots of buyers, lots of sellers, perfect information, mobile workers, no unions, no government meddling. It's simple. Demand meets supply, and the wage settles right there at the intersection, the equilibrium wage. Firms are just wage takers. They pay the going market rate.
Okay, but that sounds, well, theoretical. What about the real world? It feels messier.
It absolutely is messier. That's where imperfect labor markets come in. And several things can push wages away from that simple equilibrium. First, trade unions. Their whole goal is usually to use collective bargaining power to push wages up for their members and improve conditions.
And they can do that through negotiation or sometimes strikes, right?
Exactly. Now, the sources we looked at suggest that if unions are very strong, they can potentially raise wages above that market clearing level. The potential downside noted in some economic models is that this might lead to excess supply of labor, basically, some unemployment, as firms might hire fewer people at that higher wage.
Okay, unions are one factor. What else makes markets imperfect?
Government intervention is a big one. The most obvious example is a national minimum wage. That's a legal floor below which wages can't fall.
And the effect of that, does it cause unemployment like the union example potentially could?
Well, according to the source material, if the minimum wage is set above the natural equilibrium wage for certain jobs, particularly low-skilled ones, it can cause some excess supply. Yes, unemployment. Firms might cut back on hiring. However, the sources also point out the potential upsides. It can raise living standards for low-paid workers who keep their jobs and potentially reduce wage exploitation. So there are arguments on both sides presented in the material we reviewed. We're just outlining those potential effects here.
Understood. Keeping it neutral, what other imperfections are there?
A really important one is a monopsony employer. This is basically when there's only one major buyer of labor in a market. Think of a classic company town, where pretty much everyone works for the big factory.
So they have all the power in setting wages.
They have significant market power, yes. Because workers don't have many other options, the monopsonists can often pay lower wages and hire fewer people than would happen in a competitive market. They can depress wages below the MRP.
That sounds pretty tough for the workers.
It can be. Interestingly, the sources note that in a monopsony situation, interventions like a minimum wage or unionization might actually raise both wages and employment levels, pushing them closer to what would happen in the competitive market. It counteracts the monopsonist's power.
Fascinating. So intervention isn't always straightforward in its effects. It really depends on the market structure, which raises a good question for you listening. How much power does your employer have in the market?
Okay, so market structure matters hugely. But even within, say, a competitive market, we know jobs pay differently. A doctor earns way more than a cleaner. Why the huge gaps? It can't just be unions or monopsony power, can it? No, definitely not. Those are wage differentials. And they come from a whole host of reasons. Some are pretty obvious, like differences in skills and the amount of training needed. Years of medical school versus on-the-job training for cleaning, right?
Sure, skills and education. What else?
The nature of the work itself. Is it risky? Dangerous? Unpleasant. Think about deep-sea oil rig workers or miners. They often get higher compensating differentials for the danger and hardship. The elasticity of labor supply matters too. If a skill is incredibly rare, like a world-class opera singer, their supply is very inelastic. There are very few of them, so they can command huge wages.
Productivity differences are key too, right? Mm-hmm. Some roles just generate more value or revenue.
Absolutely. Linked back to MRP, in a way. We already mentioned unionization levels can differ across industries, creating gaps. Employer market power, employee market power, and unfortunately, discrimination still plays a part. Differences in pay based on gender, race, or other factors, even for the same work, sadly persist in some areas.
And geography. Does living somewhat expensive mean higher wages?
Often, yes. Regional differences in the cost of living usually lead to different pay scales for comparable jobs to attract workers to pricier areas. So, yeah, it's a lot of things mixed together.
Wow. It really is a complex mix. Skills, risk, scarcity, power, discrimination, location. No wonder pay varies so much. Okay, to wrap up our deep dive on your paycheck, let's touch on two final concepts that are, well, they're really insightful for understanding the true value of what you earn. These are transfer earnings and economic rent.
Yes, these are great concepts. Let's break them down. Transfer earnings is basically the minimum amount of money needed to keep you doing the job you're currently doing. Think of it as your opportunity cost. What's the minimum pay you need in your current job to not leave and take your next best alternative job? That minimum is your transfer earnings.
Okay, so the bare minimum to keep me here. What's economic rent then?
Economic rent is anything you earn above your transfer earnings. It's the extra bit you get paid because your skills are scarce or in high demand, or maybe because it's hard for others to enter your profession. The source material had a really clear example. Let's adapt it slightly. Say a top software engineer earns $200,000 a year, but maybe their next best job option, perhaps teaching computer science, would only pay $120,000. And let's say they'd be willing to stay in their current software job for anything above $130,000. So their transfer earnings are $130,000.
Right, the minimum to keep them coding.
Exactly. So the economic rent is the difference. $200,000 minus $130,000, which is $70,000. That 70 grand is rent they capture due to their valuable, perhaps scarce, skills in the software market.
So it's like a bonus payment driven by scarcity.
Precisely. It often arises when the supply of labor is inelastic, meaning not very responsive to wage changes. This happens with unique talents, highly specialized skills, long training periods, or strong professional barriers to entry. Doctors, star athletes, maybe even highly experienced tradespeople in some areas might earn significant economic rent.
That connects back to the wage differentials we talked about. Scarcity driving up pay beyond just the minimum needed to do the job.
You got it. It all links together. Understanding transfer earnings and economic rent helps explain why some fields have such incredibly high earning potential.
What a journey we've been on. Seriously, we set out to crack the code of the paycheck, and look how far we've come. We started with that core idea of derived demand, saw how firms think using MRP, then flipped to the supply side wages, sure, but also all those non-wage things. Then we got into the real world, imperfect markets, unions, minimum wages, monopsony, and finally tackled why pay differs so much, wrapping up with transfer earnings and economic rent. Mission accomplished, I think. A real shortcut to being well-informed about how the labor market actually works. You should now have a much clearer idea of what's shaping your pay and your job options.
And maybe this leaves you with a final thought, a question to ponder. How do these powerful forces, demand, supply, market structures, economic rent, how do they influence your own career choices, your ambitions? What could understanding them mean for your future decisions?
That's a brilliant question to end on. Food for thought indeed. We really hope this deep dive has given you some valuable insights and maybe sparked some new ideas. Join us next time as we continue exploring the world one deep dive at a time.